Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of September 25th, 2019. This week, I talk with Meg Kennard with the Associated Press and Jamie Lovegrove of the Post and Courier about Senator Kamala Harris and Senator Bernie Sanders' recent swings through the state, Harris's plan to staff up here, and the funeral of the late Emily England Clyburn. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. It's a doozy this week, guys. Also, make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can also rate us and review us there, too. We're also everywhere podcasts exist, including NPR One. You can listen to all four sections instead of wondering how the raid on Area 51 went. Could they stop them all? I think they did, right? No one's talking about it. Or while you think of a better either-or. Hey, we're open to suggestions. Send us a DM on Twitter or Instagram and let us know some sort of funny either-or. Hey, we're all once again suggestions. You got something funny to say? We'll put it on here. Make sure it's like, you know, PG, guys. PG-13 at most. And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Also, a reminder, we are looking for a paid news and public affairs intern here at SCETV. Work with us on The Lead and my show This Week in South Carolina. Email your resume to Amy Crouch at acrouch at scetv.org. Do it. Paid. Money. Number one, thanks again, Mega Millions jackpot winner. Speaking of money, the state newspaper reports that come the first week of December, more than 1 million South Carolinians will receive a one-time $50 rebate check from the Department of Revenue. This is paid in part by the $61 million Mega Millions windfall the state received last year. This idea was first floated in Governor Henry McMaster's executive budget. Now the state will spend about $700,000 on postage to mail the checks. Number two, the Post and Courier reports that law enforcement mowed down 10 acres of hemp near Harleyville and arrested farmer John Pendarvis for growing the crop on unlicensed land due to a mapping error. He's licensed by the state to grow hemp, but GPS coordinates required by the Agriculture Department didn't include one of his two fields. Pendarvis estimates that up to $12 million worth of hemp was turned into mulch in a matter of minutes. Now, that law doesn't specify any punishment for breaking the Department of Agriculture's licensing rules. Number three, the Associated Press reports that a growing drought in South Carolina is threatening to devastate farmers' crops right at harvest time, and officials said there are plenty of indications that dry weather will spread. The Drought Response Committee classified 31 of South Carolina's 46 counties as suffering moderate drought, the second in four worsening stages. Coastal South Carolina is fine thanks to rain from Hurricane Dorian that did not make it inland. And number four, the state newspaper reports that three people at the College of Charleston have confirmed cases of the mumps virus, prompting state health officials to deem it an outbreak. The school has isolated those who tested positive for the virus and is contacting others who may be at increased risk for infection, this according to a news release. It's unclear whether the affected are students, faculty, or staff. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week we get you just a headline, a little taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Headline: Florida man breaks into house he used to live in because, quote, he felt at home, quote, homeowner says. Turns out you can go home and get arrested because it's not your home. And just like AT and Andy Shane's souls after another Eagles loss, we bury the lead. Hail to the Redskins. They're not winning either. Over the past few days, we've seen 2020 presidential politics intersect with somber news of the passing of Emily England Clyburn, the wife of Congressman Jim Clyburn. Senator Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris visited the state over the weekend, with Harris staying on Sunday to join fellow 2020 contender Senator Elizabeth Warren, other dignitaries, and hundreds of people at Miss Emily's funeral in West Columbia. Former Vice President Joe Biden and his wife joined the Clyburn family at Emily's homegoing ceremony on Monday in Charleston. However, during the services, these 2020 contenders were seen but not heard from in any formal sense. These were very emotional moments for the Clyburn family, and those who were there offered support. To discuss the events of the weekend, we have Meg Kennard with the Associated Press and Jamie Lovegrove of the Post and Courier. Hey guys, welcome back.
Hello, good to be here.
Hey Gavin.
Busy weekend, but with that, I kind of want to start chronologically here because it was a busy weekend. And Meg, we were up at Winthrop University to see Senator Bernie Sanders hold a rally. He had about 800 students there, which was pretty impressive for a Friday evening. It was nice out, it was outside.
It's lovely.
Even though we were talking to his campaign about these outside events, they kind of keep tempting fate there, but it was nice out. But it was kind of surprising to see that big of a crowd and to hear Bernie, especially since we haven't heard from him recently because of his voice. He wasn't at the Galvin's Ferry stump.
That's right.
So it was a big turnout. What did we hear from him other than maybe some of his stump speech up there?
Sure. Well, this was an opportunity for us to really see Bernie Sanders trying to connect with that younger contingency of South Carolina voters. This was part of his college tour, which he recently kicked off up at UNC Chapel Hill. And some of his surrogates, as well as he himself, have been going around to different campuses to try to get the youth vote out. This is something that Senator Sanders didn't really focus as much on during his 2016 campaign. So particularly here in South Carolina, as he is coming back, as he's spending more time and really putting in the time and effort to campaign here, this is a certain sector of the populace that he knows he needs to reach. It's those younger voters. If he can turn them out, then perhaps he's counting on seeing that turn into some electoral success for him going into the primary. So there was a lot of energy and a lot of attention there, and I would imagine that we're going to see more of that in the coming months.
And, you know, it should be noted, too, we've seen Bernie in Myrtle Beach, and there was also kind of a similar big turnout there, too. Florence was maybe not so big. It was also Friday. It was hot outside. They were doing that Medicare for All. But it's still significant to note that he has these big crowds turning out for him.
These aren't quite the numbers that we recall seeing in the 2016 election cycle for certain. I mean, those were rallies of thousands and thousands of people, maybe not as much here in South Carolina, but I did attend several of those in other states. And so, yes, I mean, Senator Sanders does absolutely still have that ability to draw these pretty large crowds. As you know, this was a Friday afternoon on a lovely, pretty end of summer, early fall day that we saw up in Rock Hill. But there were a lot of people turned out and a lot of college students who could have been doing a bazillion other things in their weekend lives on campus. So, yes, there is certainly a lot of interest still in what he has to say.
Mm-hmm. And he really didn't even roll anything out. I mean, the next day he did kind of mention a rollout about his plan to forgive medical debt.
And he referenced that while he was up there, and we kind of all thought, well, this is something new, maybe. He's kind of, you know, skirted around a little bit, but that was something new. It continues the parade of policy proposal rollouts that we're seeing from all of the candidates. But traditionally, it was his, you know, most standard messaging for the most part.
And I probably, we can wrap up with this, but I probably should have looked at that part where he was talking about it's a Friday night, you know, you guys can go out and smoke something, maybe it's not legal, whatever. Like, he made this reference. I'm like, did Bernie Sanders just say, stay
like
in school and do drugs? Be cool, yeah. Go ahead, Jimmy.
You know, I guess one thing I would just weigh in on here is that young voters have always been Bernie Sanders' strength. Consistently in poll after poll in South Carolina and around the country, his strongest voting block is 18 to 34-year-olds. We've seen it in all the polls we've done. We've actually had him beating Joe Biden among 18 to 34-year-olds, and that's been the case in a lot of places. So the strategy of going after them is clearly a base mobilization strategy and trying to make sure that those people who do support him actually go and vote, because, of course, you know, part of the problem for candidates like Bernie in the past have been that older voters turn out in droves and younger voters don't, even if they may support him. You know, I just question whether that's going to be enough for Bernie to actually win in South Carolina or anywhere. What it seems to me he's going to have to do is start persuading older voters to change their minds about him. You know, there is some irony to the fact that a 78-year-old guy from Vermont is doing so well, is doing best among younger voters. But, I just don't know whether the numbers are there for him, even if he were to get, you know, 90% of the young vote to actually win because of how much the electorate is older. So it will, you know, obviously he can do two things at once. He can walk and chew gum at the same time. He can do this college tour, and then maybe next he can start visiting retirement communities. But, you know, he is going to have to expand beyond young progressive voters for the math to work out on him winning.
And we already know kind of some of those other contenders, some of his opponents who have that block kind of pretty locked down. We've seen it at the Galvin's Ferry stump. We saw it down in Charleston, Meg, at the NAACP Awards. But the gala they had down there where Senator Kamala Harris spoke, it was kind of reminiscent of what we saw in June when she was kind of, again, up here at the NAACP gala. And she did talk again about her, you know, her prosecutorial background, which is something that she continues to lean into. But we also saw Senator Harris talk a little bit more personally about who she is. We found out that in high school she was part of a dance group called Midnight Madness, for example. I mean, there's all these little things that are starting to flow out of. And I know this is also part of like her campaign's bigger strategy to kind of overcome that summer slump that they talked about. And especially in South Carolina, where they're now throwing more efforts into their organizing staff.
Beefing up their staff here significantly and really putting a focus on her efforts here. Obviously in Iowa as well, which she has talked about in the past week or so. But yes, I mean, this event with Senator Harris really was an opportunity for her to connect with an audience that she's been coming to see and coming to speak with for some time. But she really talked more about the NAACP itself, about her personal connections going back to her youth and childhood with civil rights and with the issues that the African-American community has battled and is still battling. And in my conversations with some of her campaign advisors, as well as her sister, Maya, who is a big part of her campaign, this is something that Senator Harris now feels that she is beginning to be ready to do. There has been criticism that she doesn't talk about herself, that she doesn't say as many personal details, which some voters have told me, as we've discussed before, that's what they need if they're going to be able to connect with somebody.
Yeah.
But we really did hear her go into that some on Saturday, and you just have to think that perhaps now that we've gotten through a lot of her policy rollouts and she's been introducing herself as a candidate, now she's beginning to take some of that time to really introduce herself just as a person and let people really get to know her.
Jimmy, she's talking about blanking, moving to Iowa. AT can use the buzz on that one.
Our I know family you family like, audience.
Pretend like I like I actually said the F word, but yeah, I mean, forking, moving to Iowa. There you go. And yeah, she's opening up offices in Florence and Orangeburg. That's going to bring up to like 5 total offices in South Carolina.
Right.
I mean, and she might be picking off staff from Senator Cory Booker if things don't seem to be going the way that they need to go with raising the $1.7 million that he needs.
Yeah, we can talk about that whole situation. I have some thoughts on that, too.
Go but, right ahead.
No, but let's before I get there,
on
the Senator Harris thing, I think what is interesting is we're seeing something that so many presidential candidates have had to grapple with, which is trying to balance how you convince multiple different states that they're the most important state.
That's right.
And this is actually much harder to do today than it might have been 20, 30 years ago because everyone's online. A lot of people are getting their news from national outlets. They're getting their news from Twitter. They're getting their news from cable news. And, you know, you can't go to one town and say that they're the most important and then go to another town and say they're the most important and not have them find out about it the way you might have been able to do when everyone was just reading their local newspaper. This is something that a lot of candidates have had to grapple with, and she's, you know, Senator Harris is now kind of doing this two-step of blanking, moving to Iowa, but before you go, come back to the place where you planted your flag in South Carolina and remind them of all the work you've already done. She's not going to stop coming here, by all accounts. She's continuing to hire up here, but it is this delicate balance of trying to win all of these different states and emphasize their importance to your campaign. And I think for her, the real situation is I think she is in a position in South Carolina to win. But they realize that it's going to be very hard to do that without first doing really well in Iowa. And in fact, if you can do really well in Iowa, you can catalyze what you have built here into a winning operation.
And for Senator Harris, I mean, she really has been keeping that focus in terms of making sure to show up at these events. As we noted, she spoke at the NAACP earlier this year already in Columbia. She committed to this event in Charleston weeks, if not months ago. And she was the first candidate to commit and is the headline sponsor of the Charleston Blue Jam that's coming up next month. So again, she wasn't at the Gallivant's Ferry Stomp, but there are other events that she is really making sure that people know, look, I know this is important and I'm going to be there.
And Jimmy, did you want to touch about what's going on with the Booker campaign?
Sure.
Just very briefly.
Jonathan Martin said something to this effect, New York Times, you know, in this memo that they put out in which they announced, the Booker campaign announced that if they don't raise $1.7 million in the next 10 days, they might not see a legitimate path forward in this race. You know, he says in the memo, this may seem like an end of quarter, you know, gimmick to raise some more money. And that's not what this is. To put it out there that bluntly, you know, is clearly addressing what I think any sort of cynical observer of this is going to think, which is that that is what it is. And we've seen an outpouring of support for Cory Booker financially from people who may not even support his campaign over the last few days because people say they want him to stay in the race. Whether or not it was a fundraising gimmick, it will, I can almost guarantee, be tremendously successful. It's one of the smarter moves I think I've seen in this campaign so far, and I would be absolutely stunned if Cory Booker actually is that close to dropping out, or as close to dropping out as they are leading people to believe. He has built this very solid operation in South Carolina. Yes, the issue for them in all of these other states, Iowa has built a really significant operation there too, is that once you built it, you need to have the funds to sustain it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Adisu is one of the smartest guys in Democratic politics today as campaign manager, and he's absolutely right that if you start retreating in the fall, there is absolutely no way you're going to win. You need to be advancing on what you've already built.
This is the time where that really is supposed
exactly.
to be happening.
Exactly. And he built a very expensive operation. Expensive operations take money to fund.
Yeah.
So they are in that position, but I am highly skeptical that they were as close as that memo made it
But
sound.
Then don't we start crying wolf at this point? I mean,
well, you can only use that move once.
Yes.
Right.
Use that move once.
Just like so many other things this campaign has done in South Carolina, you start cashing in on certain things. I mean,
yes.
Yeah. When you haven't been pointed above 5% in South Carolina
well,
since June.
Well, that's real. That's real.
You can try and get as much money as you want from people, but
the polling, not just the fundraising, but the polling still will matter going into these next rounds of debates.
Yeah.
And the standards keep changing and going up. So that's another thing that all the campaigns have to pay attention to.
Right.
Another thing to keep an eye on, but we're kind of have other things to talk about too, including Congressman Jim Clyburn's wife, Emily, who's passed away. Her funeral services this past weekend. Again, like I said in the open, we have these candidates come through, but again, they were seen. They weren't really heard from in a formal sense. And Meg, that seems to be the appropriate move. I mean, it wasn't Fritz Hollins' funeral where we're having Joe Biden up there kind of eulogizing this person. This was someone who is adjacent to politics, was a very big part of her husband's legacy, but also, you know, This is a family who's mourning right now, too.
Sure, absolutely. Most of the voices that we heard from at both of these services in Columbia and then in Charleston were people who had known, worked with, grown up with Emily Clyburn throughout the years. So this was not really taken as an opportunity for any of these candidates to come and get their face behind the podium speaking about this woman. Certainly they would have come into contact with her at some point. And they were there, if not just to remember her, but to support Jim Clyburn and to support the family, which is what I would hope we're all doing when we go to anybody's funeral, even if it's somebody that we may not have known super well. So we did see Kamala Harris, we did see Elizabeth Warren, and then on Sunday we saw Joe Biden sitting up there in the front row across the aisle from Clyburn. And we really saw a moment of, if not just Democratic unity, it was political unity as well. I mean, there were a lot of Republicans sitting out there in the audience. Governor McMaster was certainly there at the first services, as was Senator Scott. We saw him yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this was a moment of remembrance and a moment of reverence. And of course, the room was filled with politicians. This was a political family. That's unavoidable.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, you know, more attention really paid to supporting the Clyburn family rather than trying to win any votes over.
Yeah, no, and we did hear from Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who did make some brief remarks during the first ceremony at the expense of Mayor Steve Benjamin's time. I did see Benjamin talk with Clyburn before. I don't know if that was prearranged or what, or if he mentioned that at that point. But, you know, we did hear some of that. Jamie, what were your takeaways from the service you went to, obviously, up here in West Columbia?
She was a remarkable woman, and all of the testimony about her reflects that. You know, certainly those of us in South Carolina have known that for a long time, and anyone who's read Jim Clyburn's book, Blessed Experiences, that he wrote in 2014 would know the profound impact she's had on his life. You know, what I would say furthermore is that what these last couple of days have demonstrated, perhaps better than anything you might ever see, is just how profound Jim Clyburn's influence is in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone ever doubted it, because we talk it up a lot, especially when we're talking about the Democratic primary, and people might say, oh, you know, nobody's really a kingmaker. Clyburn is as influential a figure as you could imagine in a state political system. And the folks, the thousands of folks, when you combine those two services that came out, all of the most influential people in the state, anyone who is anyone in Democratic politics was there to pay their respects to him and to Miss Emily.
Votes were canceled in the Congress.
Of course, he remains incredibly influential there. And of course, the fact that we saw dozens of members of Congress come down for this, including the Speaker, including the Majority Leader, you know, that certainly underscores his influence up there too. But you know, the fact that we saw this chief from South Carolina pouring out their love and respect for a woman who was very, as was, you know, pointed out many times, a quiet figure, someone who did not seek the limelight. Was obviously, she was quite ill the last few years, and so she just wasn't that public regardless. But even when she was not, you know, she was never someone who, never one of those congressional wives who was kind of trying to hog the limelight.
Although it certainly sounds like she did have her, moments of influence.
Behind the scenes, she was very powerful.
Right.
And clearly she was respected in Congress, too, as Speaker Pelosi said, you know, when they would talk and have tough problems to confront in Congress, you know, one of the things they'd ask, what does Ms. Emily think?
Good barometer.
Right. So, you know, it was a nice moment to be able to step back from the storm and drang of the presidential race and to reflect on, you know, the profound impact that she has had on the state and
Jim Clyburn's life. I mean, you can definitely he spoke to that in his eulogy.
Absolutely. I mean, this is nearly, you know, 6 decades of marriage. Mm-hmm. That is astounding to think about in this day and age. And so for him, this is not only encapsulates his whole adulthood, but it's certainly his whole political career. And so for him to talk about the influence and the relationship that he and his wife had, it's certainly been part of who he is as a politician and a public figure. And for him to get behind the podium himself at the services in Charleston and to talk about that, I mean, to see that, it's just, it's a very salient reminder that I think we all need sometimes, that these public figures are so influential and they're so important and they wield so much power, but they are human beings. And to see Jim Clyburn and the members of his family, all of whom are involved in one way or another in our community, to really see them going through those moments and be willing to share it with the public, I think speaks a lot to what kind of a family they are.
Yeah, it was a good moment to reflect and pay our respects to Ms. Emily. Thank you again to Meg Kinnard with the Associated Press and Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gavin.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020-related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. The Island Packet reports that Hilton Head Island teacher Logan Cunningham announced that he is no longer running for the Republican nomination in the 1st Congressional District. He will instead run for Beaufort County Council. The move leaves 4 other Republicans in the race. Logan Cunningham has no relation to the Democratic Congressman Joe Cunningham. And now for your Nikki Haley News Minute. The Associated Press's Meg Kinnard reports that former South Carolina Governor and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley has recently closed on a Kiowa Island home. Her office said the family will be splitting time between Kiowa and New York until her son graduates from high school next spring. The move is fueling speculation that Haley, who is on the speaking circuit and on Boeing's board of directors, will soon return to politics. But first, Haley will begin her book tour this November for her book, With All Due Respect, Defending America with Grit and Grace. The tour will include a stop in Spartanburg on November 16th and Charleston on November 17th. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here with some state trivia for us? Hey, Russ.
Hey.
Who'd you bring with you?
They didn't leave. Jamie and Meg didn't leave. They're still here.
I have moved into the studio.
I'm glad they're here because I have a question for them.
Oh.
And that is, who, if anyone, will Jim Clyburn endorse in the Democratic primary?
Russ joins the legions of people who ask us this question all over the state.
You know, look, obviously he has the longest relationship with Joe Biden, and his politics may be most similar to Joe Biden's in terms of his view of Congress and the way the legislating works. Of course, there has been some chatter you know, several months ago with Bakari Sellers, who has endorsed Kamala Harris, coming out and claiming that Biden, that Clyburn had tacitly endorsed Biden. But he has not, as of yet. I mean, I think we've talked about that issue before, but in a way, that comment served as a way for him to endorse without actually having to do it. Anyway, he has given them all a fair shake. I would not be surprised if he does it in the very last week.
Closing
if
days.
He does, you know, which is what he did in 2016. You know, if it's very clear at that point that Biden's winning. If it's a nail biter, I would be pretty surprised to see him come down. Because
Meg agrees
with
what Jamie's
saying. Play out.
I do.
Well, E.T. wanted to know if you, yeah.
That would be interesting. Now, he is the titular head of the Democratic Party, being the senior Democratic elected official in the state.
Yes, he's both effectively and literally.
And as you all know, he was first elected in 1992. He's serving his 14th term in the House, the first African-American from South Carolina elected to Congress since Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. Republican Tim Scott was elected to the U.S. House in 2010. Of course, we all know the story how he got into the Senate. But did you know that the first African-American elected to Congress from South Carolina was Joseph Rainey of Georgetown in 1870 during the Reconstruction period? Mm-hmm. Of course, these are federal offices. Mm-hmm. But did you know that African-Americans have been elected to some of the highest state offices in South Carolina as well? Now, of course, we're going back to the Reconstruction period, mm-hmm. immediately after the Civil War, when the state was under presidential-ordered Reconstruction. The Republican Party was the dominant national party, and a number of African-Americans actually came to the state simply to take part in the political process, and a number of them ended up in political offices, elected to office. Mm-hmm. African-Americans, beginning with the elections of 1868 and 1870, were elected to a number of offices. So our question is, African-Americans have been elected to which of the following state offices? State offices. A, state treasurer. B, lieutenant governor. C, governor. D, all of the above.
Now, we usually say all of the above, but we know that that's
not we know that's not true because, we know that's, you know, the reason why I know that's not true is because Pitchfork Ben Tillman created the Constitution to deliberately try to, you know, ensure that if an African-American was elected governor, the legislature would have all the power and the white legislature would be able to stop him from enacting his agenda or her, but obviously at the time him, and that has never happened.
But so we're talking about a half century before Ben Tillman.
See how this works?
There were, you know, in the early days of Reconstruction, there were 15 African Americans serving in the U.S. House of Representatives. Six of them were from South Carolina. So there have been a number of blacks elected during this period in South Carolina.
This is when it starts to be a reminder to me that none of us went to public schools in South Carolina, where we would have had South Carolina history.
So, Russ, let's get those again for all of our listeners.
State treasurer, lieutenant governor, governor, all of the above.
I'm thinking we got to pick one. I'm thinking treasurer, because I really feel like I would have heard about lieutenant governor. We know governor's not the case. I mean, I know you're saying different times, but I mean,
I think he has a point about the different times, which just it makes me question my own sanity a little bit here, but
welcome.
Status quo.
Well, there are actually two correct answers: state treasurer and lieutenant.
Amy. Oh. Yeah, Amy was signaling something to me.
But no, there was a governor. An African American was never elected governor during the Reconstruction.
I'm glad my fundamental understanding about a key fact in South Carolina political history is not incredibly wrong.
But African Americans during this time also were elected Secretary of State. There were a number of other offices that they were elected to. But that
could have included, but you wanted to throw us off guard. I see how it is.
Speaker of the House. There was an African-American Speaker of the House. But it's interesting, this didn't occur at the local level. While this was going on at the state level, sheriffs, clerks of court, things like that, all remain white. Mm. There were no African-Americans elected into those offices. Oh.
What did you guys answer? I was like watching Amy signal me something. I said state treasurer, and everyone else kind of maybe agreed with it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a trick question.
Yeah, you didn't let us know there were multiple, you know. You could
That's how it
multiple.
Goes. So it was A and B, right? We said
it
treasurer
could be or B.
A or B. Oh,
Or B? So we were correct then, because we chose A.
Yeah.
There's a lot of miscommunication going on there.
Order! I know what I'm doing.
So, I'm going to be honest with you guys. This part of the episode kind of got a little out of hand. We had a lot of voices in the studio, and I don't know about you, but I can't really stand those podcasts where people are shouting over each other. So, I'm going to go ahead and call for some order.
Zen!
I said order.
Order.
Instead of me doing my British accent, we got a professional.
Order!
Were you supposed to end this? Well, I guess we'll just pull it out. Well, it's good to know,
Russ. I think we should conclude this entire conversation and then end it right now.
I think. Anyway, thanks, Russ. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, Meg.
Thank you.
Thank you. Fun times.
That was a hot mess. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag, that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to SCLEDE at SCETV.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Associated Press and the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on September 24th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. Secret message. It's time to begin scrapbooking.